This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
The Collaborative Embedded Physical Education Program, a specific program, EPIC in Delaware. And we're now going to take a step back and we will now hear about the importance of physical activities and how they can be adapted for children and adolescents with physical and developmental disabilities. And our next speaker is Dr. Mary Dubon, who is the Program Director for Pediatric Rehabilitation Medicine Fellowship and Associate Director, the Kelly Institute for Adaptive Sports Research, Spalding Rehabilitation Hospital. She is a pediatric rehabilitation medicine physician. She's also with pediatric sports medicine at Boston Children's Hospital. Welcome, Dr. Dubon.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to talk about something near and dear to my heart. So I'm going to go ahead and share my slides here. Once again, thank you so much for the invitation. And this is a topic that I find to be really important. I really appreciate the invitation to speak on it. My background is I am a pediatric rehab and a pediatric sports medicine physician. So this area of physical activity and sports for kids with disabilities is an area that I focus my career on. I have no relevant financial disclosures. So this is going to be obviously something that most of us in the audience here know and is review. So physical activity guide for kids. So when we're looking at that school age group, the 6 to 17 year olds, 60 minutes of physical activity daily. And that's the play 60, which is that really catchy phrase that has come up as well, speaks to that, right? And so there's more specifics of it in terms of your aerobic activity, your muscle strengthening activity, and your bone strengthening activity. Now, usually when I'm doing this in person, I have a show of hands of how many people know the guidelines for kids with disabilities. And usually I have very few hands that that raise up. So obviously in a virtual setting, less able to do that. But this is when I have my shocker slide that actually I just changed only a couple things on this slide. I just changed the fact that I wrote with disabilities. And I changed some of those logos or those icons to be more inclusive and adaptive. So it really is the same guidelines. And so this is, I think, a really important take home point is that the guidelines are the same for all children. There's a little asterisk there though, right? So that asterisk is, you know, there may be some considerations for an individual patient based on their medical comorbidities, based on their diagnosis, that things may have to be adjusted or adapted. But the goal is, if a child is able to, we want them to also meet the physical activity guidelines. There's a little bit of a movement of making specific guidelines for diagnosis, which I think is really helpful, but we're not there yet with all diagnoses. So the other thing I like to talk about is I know my talk is entitled Adaptive Sports and Parasports, because that's going to be a lot of what I'm going to talk about. But I think it's important to take a few steps back. And I know this is a reminder for so many of us, but many of our kids and children that we take care of who have disabilities actually participate in sports in the mainstream setting. So just because you have a disability doesn't mean that you participate in adaptive sports. There are some folks that actually participate in mainstream sports and in inclusive or adaptive sports. So let me think about para and adaptive sports. So I always like to give both terms. In the United States, they are often used interchangeably, but this is the technical terminology. So para sports comes from the term in parallel. So these are sports specifically geared towards individuals with disabilities that are in parallel to sports in the general population. The famous and big version of that is the Paralympics, which is the most elite level of para sports. But the term para sports doesn't mean just Paralympics. It means, a Paralympic style sport, but you could play a para sport recreationally in the community. Then they talk about adaptive sports. So in terms of adaptive sports, they are adapted from other sports. So some para sports are adaptive and some para sports are unique to this population. So wheelchair basketball is adapted from mainstream population basketball, right? And then goalball is something that exists only in the adaptive, in the para sport world rather, and does not exist in the general population. So technically goalball is a para sport without being an adaptive sport. In Europe, from what I hear, they use those terms a little bit more specifically than we do. For us, typically adaptive sports and para sports are used fairly interchangeably. Then we think about Special Olympics. So, looking at the spectrum of disability, right? So for para and adaptive sports, as we just spoke about, that's generally talking about sports that are similar to Paralympics and focus mostly on physical disability, focus on also athletes who are blind or have low vision. There are some areas of Paralympics and para sport that if you have an intellectual disability, you could qualify as well. But generally, a big organization, probably the largest organization for sports for individuals with intellectual developmental disability is through Special Olympics. Special Olympics is novice through elite. And that's something that I always have as a teaching point too, is that there are World Games, there's USA Games, and that there's different classifications there, just as exists in the para sport world, where you're classified so that you're playing against people at the similar a function level as you, so that it levels the playing field. This is another one that, as I started learning more about adaptive sports world, that I learned about. And so I always like to include it too, because thinking about the spectrum of function, thinking about disabilities, but also about sensory conditions too, right? So if you hear me talk about the Paralympics and talking about adaptive sports and talking about para sports, I didn't mention the deaf population. I didn't mention those who are hard of hearing. And so know that there are programs. Deaflympics is one of them. That's the most elite version of sports specifically for deaf athletes. But there are also collegiate programs and recreational programs and local programs too. So just knowing your options. And certainly I know deaf athletes who participated in mainstream sports too. So again, I think just wanted to start out with that introduction of what the different options are when we're talking about sports participation for individuals with disabilities. So one thing that we do have to think about is precautions. And so this is to keep people safe, right? So precautions may be something that is a restriction. It may just be something that's like an alert or a flag. So I mean, just as in the general population, you would want to know if somebody has asthma, right? So that you have kind of a safety plan in place for that. That doesn't mean because you have asthma, you can't play. That means, okay, these are things that we need to know about, right? So someone might have a situation with their bones where they're at increased risk of fractures. And so that would be something that you would want to know about. And you would want to make sure you're attuned to that as, you know, a sports medicine doctor or another doctor that's caring for athletes. As a coach, you want to make sure you're attuned to that. And you want to make sure that you're making any adjustments that need to be adjusted due to that. But that's really not, like, I think that's something that overwhelms sometimes people, but remember that that's a team sport too, in and of itself. So if somebody has a diagnosis where they have to see multiple specialists, talking to all those specialists is really how you get the answer of any considerations that should be, considered. When I first went into this area, I gave a talk and someone came up to me after and was like, "It was so great to hear you talk about sports people with disabilities. My brother has Down syndrome, and growing up was told that because he had Down syndrome, he couldn't play sports." And so, that kind of comment sticks with me because I don't really, like, I have yet to in my career have somebody that is interested in being physically active and interested in sports have an answer to them that they can't play anything. And so there may be some modifications, there may be some precautions to consider. There may be some sports that would not be safe, but that doesn't mean that you can't play anything. All right, so then this is just a very general framework that I think about, like, physical activity and sports participation. We know that top arrow, right? We know that top arrow is that there's so much research, right, that it has improvements in your physical health, in your mental health. There's social benefits. There's so many benefits of physical activity. We also know from the sports medicine world that you can have injury and pain that can happen because of sports participation or physical activity. Not to say not to do it, of course, but there's also that path that can go as well too. So when I think about evidence or think about research, I kind of have framed it in this way. So I'm first going to just talk about what's out there in terms of the evidence, in terms of this beginning part, just about the participation. And I would say this is the area that's been most researched in terms of children and adolescents with disabilities. So how do we improve physical activity and sports participation? What are the barriers or facilitators? What are the numbers in terms of participation? So what we know is that the participation in sports among youth with disabilities is decreased compared to their age-matched peers. There's also a decreased diversity of sports participation. I always compare it to the fact that if you wanted to play soccer or basketball, if you don't have a disability, there's probably multiple options, even within your town or community, for so many, especially if you're in an urban or suburban area across the country. But if you have a disability, and so you have certain accommodations, or you're at a wheelchair level, for instance, there may not be options that are in your town, likely not. There may not be options in your state. Sometimes folks have to travel an hour, hour and a half to get to that. So certainly, it's not surprising that there's decreased sports participation, and not surprising that there's decreased diversity of sports. I always say wheelchair basketball is one of the more common sports that we hear about, sled hockey. I played on a basketball team when I was younger. I was really not good at basketball. And so if I was in a situation where I was a wheelchair user and my option was sled hockey or wheelchair basketball, I'm not sure that I would be playing sports, right? And so, or I'd be playing something that wasn't really what I was passionate about. So I think that's something that we have to think about and keep in mind as you know, advocates too, for the patients that we care for and for those in the community, is that, you know, how do we advocate for more resources to be able to do inclusive and adaptive sports so that it's a variety of different options, so that people can find things that they prefer. Barriers and facilitators. There are some that are similar between the general population and individuals with disabilities, but there are certainly some that are different. And so I'll point out some of the ones that are different, because motivation and time, those are things that are barriers for most of us. But medical comorbidities or physical functioning, communication. So again, with functioning being, something that is more difficult, then that's a bigger barrier. With functioning being higher, then that's less of a barrier. Access to transportation. So for many folks with disabilities, depending on what the disability is, depending on resources, they may have to rely on public transportation or other transportation options to get them from A to B. And especially if we're talking about an adaptive sports program being far away, that may be a barrier, as well as just access to adaptive sports, which we spoke about. But certainly we see a lot of facilitators that are similar to the general population. If you know that it's good for you, if you have friends that are doing it, if you know that it has social opportunities, and we see that folks with higher level of physical and cognitive skills tend to be more, there's less barriers and more facilitators to sports participation. So now I want to next move to the ICF model of the World Health Organization, which I know is review for most. And what that is basically looking at disability, not from the medical model, but thinking of it more from the biopsychosocial model and seeing that everything is interacting, right? And so disability is not necessarily just cut and dry. You have this diagnosis, so therefore you have a disability, but looking at it from the perspective of everything that takes into play there. So looking at an example, if there's somebody that has a spinal cord injury, has paraplegia, so paralysis of both of their legs, they may have difficulty dancing. In a very cut and dry, you know, older school approach of looking at that would be, well, they have just difficulty dancing because of the paraplegia. But actually, you can dance if you have paraplegia, right? And so let's look at this a little bit further. Barriers in the community, there's actually no adaptive or inclusive dance programs, right? There's financial restrictions because in order to get to the one dance program that's there, you have to pay a fee to get there, but also have to pay for transportation to get there. And that might be a restriction. And then maybe there's restrictions in the dance program participation. So, that is affecting somebody's difficulty with dancing. And so it's not really necessarily a cut and dry of a spinal cord injury and therefore difficulty dancing, but taking a few steps back and realizing from an advocacy lens, maybe there's some ways that we can help intervene here and help promote those activities and support those activities. When looking also at those barriers and facilitators, I have found from my work and literature searches thus far, finding out that sports participation is less in general in children and adolescents with disabilities is fairly well documented in the literature. Probably we could still afford to do more work in the area of individual disabilities and how that impacts. Barriers and facilitators is, you know, decently out there in the literature. Interventions that actually help overcome those barriers and facilitators much less. And so we don't really have much takeaways, even from what I was able to find, to tell us much yet about evidence for increasing physical activity, though we do have some suggestions in the literature for things to do. Here's just some work in that area of that flowchart that you remember that I showed you at the beginning of that participation that I've been able to be a part of. So I just wanted to highlight some of the research aspects that, that I've been involved with. One was just a retrospective study that we did where we looked at sports participation in youth with lower limb deficiency and amputation. The social history for one of our orthopedic surgeon colleagues was typically to report what sports kids played. And we showed pretty high rates of sports participation, including lower limb heavy sports such as soccer. So that did show that actually in children with lower limb amputation, sports participation actually can be high, which is something that we've observed clinically, but hadn't really been in the literature yet. This paper is currently under review. And I'll say the reason that we're doing that is just because disability is so complex and not everyone with a disability, you know, has the same disability, and not two people with a disability are having the same experience, right? So just to diversify that information that we have out there. That prompted us to do a six-site cross-sectional design study. So you can see the stars here. So we have a site at Boston Children's Hospital. We have a site at Children's Healthcare of Atlanta, at Nationwide Children's Hospital, Scottish Rite for Children in Dallas, Texas, at Seattle Children's Hospital in Washington, and at Rady Children's Hospital in San Diego. We did a cross-sectional design one-time survey, and we had a lot of questions on there. With Branching Logic, 104 questions, we did reimburse our participants. And we looked at children through young adults with transverse lower limb amputation or congenital limb deficiency, and asked them a bunch of questions, including their sports participation, including how COVID impacted them, because it was during the time of early COVID, including contralateral limb pain that may have come up, and also barriers and facilitators. And I think so far, you know, we're in the data analysis phase. So far, I think the biggest thing that I thought was interesting. So similarly, we did see decent sports participation in this group, lower limb heavy sports that they were able to play. But we also saw that about 30% of individuals felt like there was a barrier in terms of coaches' comfort with coaching them. And so that's something that can be modifiable, right? And there can be future plans and programs to help educate coaches in the community about how to maybe adjust coaching for somebody who has an amputation. And also of note, most of these kids actually were playing mainstream sports compared to adaptive sports. ADAPT was our research project that was adolescents with disabilities increasing activity through peer health coaching via technology. What we did was we created a topic wheel that's a colorful wheel that's here that includes, I'll list off what it includes, but it includes those barriers and facilitators we mentioned. So motivation, confidence, health conditions, social factors, time, physical fitness, accessibility, physical abilities. And we had a small pilot group. We're looking at really feasibility in the study, but we had adolescents with spina bifida or cerebral palsy, and we paired them up with a young adult who was active in the adaptive sports world. The adolescents that we had were not participating in physical activity at the recommended guidelines, but they were very motivated. And so they worked to try to overcome those barriers. Again, this was mostly a feasibility study. It did seem like this was a feasible intervention and something that hopefully we could get further funding to look at more in depth. So now looking at that other arrow, so that injury and pain, thinking about biomechanics, athletic training considerations, coaching considerations, things that can help, you know, understand injuries, but also lead to injury prevention. So what we know about parasport injuries is mostly from the Paralympic Games. Starting in the London Games, they started collecting standardized data about injuries and started putting out some great articles with that information. Most of what we have, though, is on these elite athletes, and most of it is not pediatric. So rates are similar to injuries in other sports. Wheelchair athletes have more upper extremity injuries, ambulatory athletes more lower extremity injuries, sprains, strains, skin injuries were most common. Winter sports, high speed, more contusion, fractures, head injuries. Summer sports, you see a lot of skin injuries such as blisters, sunburn, wheelchair track, you see median ulnar mononeuropathies. And then other considerations and injuries to think about are heat-related, overheating or hyperthermia, hypothermia as well. When thinking about the pediatric adaptive athlete, the last paper that I am aware of that specifically was a research paper looking at pediatric adaptive athletes was from 1993. So it's been a while. We are trying to improve that. And with that, we kind of learned that it was a one-time survey. Most people reported some sort of injury, but injury was defined pretty broadly. So we're outdated at this point and we need more information. So that brings us to some work that we're doing right now. Right now we are, this is for adults, but we were funded by the American Medical Society for Sports Medicine Collaborative Research Network to do a study. I'm co-PI with Dr. Asif and Dr. Heasley listed here as well, where we are looking at injury in para athletes who are adults who are in their recreational league, and we're looking longitudinally. And that's not something done to our knowledge in the US previously. It has been done in Sweden for elite athletes longitudinally, but this is hopefully filling a gap of the non-elite athletes as well. And we're also looking at that same, a similar study, but where we're looking at it in kids. And this is a pilot feasibility study where we're trying to use that same tool that was used by Dr. Christina Fager, who's a PhD in Sweden, trying to use that same tool and see if it's feasible to use that in children so that we could start looking longitudinally at injuries in pediatric para athletes. Now, thinking about Special Olympics, I'm in the midst of finishing up a scoping review looking at injuries that have been reported in the literature in Special Olympics and other intellectual disability settings. And there's really not a ton of studies. There's more as of recently, which is great. We do know that there's musculoskeletal injuries. It's been a lot reported pretty similar to general population, but the details are often limited just based on the way data is able to be collected at these games. It's not the same resources that you have at the Paralympics games. So there's definitely more research needed in this area. So where do we go from here? So thinking about that first whole section about participation, this is definitely a really great read for anyone who hasn't read it. I am constantly looking for the clinical reports from American Academy of Pediatrics on the topic, and they've put out a couple of them and they're really great. So promoting the participation of children and adolescents with disabilities in sports, recreation, and physical activity. So if there's one read that I would recommend from this presentation, it would be this article. They do a really nice job about how to advocate, and really they focus on the fact that anyone that takes care of children and adolescents, it's all of our responsibility to know those like guidelines for physical activity to be able to counsel and promote physical activity and get people going in the right direction and help them overcome those barriers. This is another article that probably many of you have read. It's kind of a famous article and really speaks to how to counsel on things like improving physical activity. And so it's the efforts in child disability. I swear this is how we should think. And those efforts are fitness, function, family factors, friendships, and fun. So it takes a little bit of the stress off that conversation where sometimes I think it's hard to know where to start. And so this is just plugging it into a little bit of a loose translation, but plugging it in a little bit to the ICF type framework. And this is based on how they did it in that article. We're thinking about barriers and facilitators in terms of fitness, thinking about their motivation, their knowledge, and skills in terms of function, addressing how it's social and there's friendships, trying to get like, what is fun for you? And that's where you want to focus. What's fun for that individual person? And that's what you want to build on to help figure out what is the right fit. Because again, basketball was not the right fit for me. Dance was, right? And so sometimes it's a little trial and error. And I think I've seen many individuals be like, I'm not an athlete. They kind of have this idea about it, but there's so many different options of activities that can get you physically active and it should be fun. And then also family factors too, making sure that the family is part of the discussion, the decision, because, signing somebody up for something or encouraging them to do something that might not work with the resources that the family has or the transportation options is not going to work either. So right, making sure we're thinking about that piece as well. Another thing I wanted to touch on too is universal design, adjusting things and having modifications. So that you know, in this example, physical education works for so many different individuals. And so this could be, you know, incorporating multiple strategies, multiple ways in which someone can participate so that a child doesn't feel like just because I have modifications in gym class, I'm going to be singled out, right? You can actually, as a, you know, as someone who's a gym teacher, they can actually design a curriculum that does use more universal design. Hey, there's three different options of where you start on this course. Give people the choice. And so somebody who wants to challenge themselves more might go at the part that's further away to start on the track. And somebody that needs the modifications might start at the spot that's closer, but maybe someone else is going to join them too. And it's not something that's looked as them being different, but it was an option or a choice. And they can proactively basically anticipate the needs of that class based on what they know, or just based on their history of knowing what the variety of modifications might be needed in a classroom setting. So then thinking about that injury and pain, you know, just a note to know about the pre-participation physical resources so that when you're screening somebody for sport participation, there is the wonderful monograph that exists as a combination of multiple subspecialties, including American Academy of Pediatrics. They do have an athletes with disabilities supplement form and a chapter in their book that goes over questions that you want to ask just from a safety perspective to make sure for a medical clearance. And then Special Olympics, just a note that Special Olympics does use a different clearance form. And I was pointed out, this was pointed out to me years ago by the medical director of Special Olympics. And so I've always made sure to include that. And now American Academy of Pediatrics also includes that on their website. So that if you go find the PPE form, scroll down a little bit and you'll be able to find the link for the Special Olympics form too, which again, just asks slightly different questions. And so they prefer this form over, over the AAP form. Being prepared for sporting events. So I think just, you know, we don't have a lot of evidence yet, but, you know, being like, I firmly believe that any child, whether you have a disability or not, should have the same access to care, right? And so, you know, if the basketball game is being covered by somebody on a sideline perspective, which it may or may not be, the wheelchair basketball game should be too, right? And so volunteering, getting involved in the community, and then just thinking and trying to anticipate. For instance, you can see in this picture here, the wheel fell off, right, in this event. And so you might want to actually have like a wrench and equipment to help out with, in addition to having, you know, your EpiPen and your other supplies that you're going to have, your ice, et cetera. And then areas of needing more research of ways to actually decrease those barriers and facilitators, injury patterns, in the para athletes and the athletes with intellectual disability in terms of recreational youth in particular, injury prevention in para athletes and athletes with intellectual disability. We don't have much on that in terms of evidence. Certainly there's coaching techniques that people have used, but nothing that's been, you know, truly proven by evidence. So I will, with that, thank you for your time. And I think we can pass it on to questions.
Well, thank you so very much for especially all the F words. So you may have addressed this. I had to take a step away, but what is the role and responsibilities of schools in providing inclusive para-adaptive sports?
It's a great question. So schools can be a huge piece of it. Just, you know, somebody that is a close friend of mine, Ian, who is now a Paralympic former Paralympic athlete, has won 7 medals. She speaks to the fact that it was actually the track host at her school that said, hey, I learned about this thing called wheelchair track. You should try it out. And she's like, I'm not an athlete. And that's her story. And that's how she became truly a really world-class athlete. And so I think that that's a huge piece of it. There are ways that public schools in particular can get involved and can actually have children or adolescents be participating, for instance, on their track team, but they're on an adaptive track. And so I am able to share later a link that would be helpful. You could look up who the contacts in your state are. And so I don't have it exactly on hand, but I can pass it along to be passed along to folks later, because I think it is very helpful.
Great. And just related to that, are there standards for schools? Like, you know, that they must provide X, Y, and Z, et cetera?
Yeah, it's a great question. So, and I think a little bit of a complicated question. In terms of sports, not that I'm aware of, in terms of just in general, you know, 504 and ADA. So there's the accessibility piece, and you have to be able to modify a curriculum. So in terms of gym class, being able to modify a curriculum, yes, but in terms of sports in particular, not that I'm aware of right now.
Thank you.
This is just wonderful work. And sports, I think a lot of people got out of their habits because of COVID and are having a hard time getting back in, getting their programs restarted. Do you have any thoughts about that and how to make it a priority? Because people, you know, people tend sometimes think of sports as being less core somehow, even though I think it's quite core.
Yeah, no, we definitely saw that with COVID. I appreciate that being brought up. So I think what's hard too is just to make a comment on is just developmentally, it depends on where someone's at. Because if they're at that age where like developmentally, like getting involved in something gets super exciting and that's part of your identity, and then all of a sudden you back off and everyone is at their house and not able to participate in it. I've seen that in the mainstream community as well as folks with disabilities. And so I think it's a universal issue. I think that, you know, in terms of as a clinician, what we can do is bring it up, you know, in terms of just it being part of the core, right, of what we talk about. And I think that kind of using those like F word techniques about how to get people back thinking about it and interested in it usually is the guidance that I would give in terms of like the social aspect and like the health aspect, because I do think as a community, like it's going to take us years to kind of, I think, get fully back to that.
So there's a question from the audience. Do you have suggestions on any sports exercise options for individuals who are previously active and were told to stop due to new medical therapies, for example, suprapubic catheters? And so in brackets, I'm thinking, you know, is there a role for OTs and PTs in this as well?
Yeah, it's, oh gosh, that's a great question. So I think that part of what's overwhelming sometimes to folks about this is that it's so individualized, right? And so I think that especially if you're working with new medical precautions or you're working with like surgical precautions, it's gonna be a case by case situation. Now, I will say there's definitely, you know, and I'm happy to share later if there's a way to do it, there's definitely a list of resources that can be helpful. So NICPAD is an organization, it's through the government that basically is all about physical activity for people with disabilities or medical conditions. So that's NCHPAD. And so a quick Google search will get you there. That is definitely a great resource. It also has an area, it's been a while since I've been on it, but it has an area where people can post their own videos through their own experience. So, you know, realizing that that's not necessarily vetted, but it is something where someone who's maybe gone through that before actually can connect to somebody who's new to it. And so I think that that's been a really nice community that has formed. I think that the role of PT and OT is an interesting one, because sometimes when I'll ask people what their physical activity is that they're participating in, they'll say, well, okay, he goes to PT 2 times a week. And I try to move away from counting that as physical activity, because oftentimes that might be stretching. Yes, there may be some strengthening work and conditioning with it, but I worry sometimes that for kids with disabilities, sometimes that's what's checking the box. And I don't know that that really should be what is. Yes, thank you. PT, physical therapy, OT is occupational therapy. Yeah, that I don't know that that is what should always be checking the box. Now, if somebody has a new suprapubic catheter, I would probably try to do, you know, I don't know exactly what the precautions are for that, but maybe pool obviously wouldn't be allowed at that point. But I would think like, you know, focusing on maybe seated activities that are going to be using the arms more and such. So, and there's things like seated yoga, seated Zumba that can happen. And even if you're not necessarily using a wheelchair, you could find those on YouTube.
Do you have information about studies or programs on improving physical activities in the adult population, especially those in group homes?
So I I may not know all that's out there. I have, in general, when I've done literature searches and I recognize that I may have not seen everything, I have, in general, seen more literature on the fact that it's decreased and less literature on how we improve it. And I think that's the movement that we need to make as a field. There was a really great push from the public health world about trying to make sure that if we're talking about barriers, that we're actually trying to address them too. And so less epidemiologic work to say, hey, this is an issue, and more action work. So I don't know of anything. That doesn't mean that it doesn't exist, but I wouldn't be surprised if it doesn't. I think that things that, I think that the whole idea of fun is huge, right? So I think that that's going to be a big piece of it. And I'll tell you, when I've been working with individuals with disabilities since I was in high school. And when I was in college, I did Best Buddies with at Notre Dame, where I went to college. And I'm sure many of you are familiar with Best Buddies, and probably some of you involved too. And when I started, so many of the events were centered around sitting in a lounge and watching movies, and there was coloring, and there was a lot of sweet snacks. And that's fine. But I could see that that probably wasn't like necessary. Like, we could have done better, right? Like, we could have done something that was more engaging, that was healthier. So, just little things that we wound up doing is we had like a science fair day that was like spread out, and people got to walk around. And so you weren't just sitting down, right, watching a movie. So that was like a piece of it. And then, I've seen like field days and, activities like that. And I think just trying to make it fun and engaging, because I think the default is it's easier sometimes to not. But I think like challenging that and trying to get outside and be active, I think, is a huge piece of it. Yeah.
Wow. Well, Dr. Dubon, thank you so much for priming us to consider fun adapted physical activities.
Absolutely. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.